All right, Tom, of course, we should mention you've changed the name and identifying information of this case and the type of police work this person exactly does. But can you present the case?
Mr. Walsh is a 68-year-old retired Boston police officer, comes in with some cough and fatigue. He does have a history of coronary disease. I saw him in, I guess it was middle of April, late April, after I had seen the Flex slides. History notable for coronary disease, status post recent angioplasty with stent placement, and he was on aspirin and Plavix when I saw him. He had a CAT scan and PET scan obtained to evaluate his symptoms of cough and fatigue. And on his CAT scan, he has a large hilar mass. He had multiple nodules in his lungs. His PET scan was markedly positive in that primary mass, also positive in several of these small little nodules, as well as positive in bone. His brain MRI was negative, so he had multiple positive bone lesions on PET, multiple lung nodules, and he had a core biopsy done to make a diagnosis. It was a moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma, which was TTF1 positive, CK7, CK20. I like to show this slide. TTF1, which is something we kind of thought was a throwaway, might actually turn out to be an incredibly important target in lung cancer therapy. And it's been something we've been wondering, what is this molecule, TTF1, for the past several years? But now some of the best genomics work seems to consistently show that TTF1 is an important oncogene in lung cancer development. TTF1 is thyroid transcription factor 1. And if you look at many of the large genome-wide sequencing efforts at the Broad, at WashU in St. Louis, maybe at some of the institutions that people have around the table, TTF1 is consistently coming up as an amplified oncogene in lung cancer.
It's obviously expressed in the thyroid. That's how it got its name to begin with. It is not expressed in adenocarcinomas of non-lung histology. And the reason it was used by the pathologists in the beginning was when they got an adenocarcinoma, they didn't know necessarily if it came from lung or from somewhere else. So 90% of adenocarcinomas that originated in the lung are TTF1 positive, whereas 99% of breast cancers and stomach cancers are TTF1 negative.
All right, let's go back to the case.
So anyway, his final pathology was moderately differentiated. Adeno was EGFR wild type. He was a smoker. He was EGFR positive by IHC. He was also RAS wild type at this point. So do you give him carboplatin Taxol? Do you give him cisplatin, vinorelbine, and cetuximab according to the FLEX study? Do you give him carbotaxol and Bev? He doesn't have hemoptysis. He does have vascular disease, which always concerns you a little bit. And how do you think about the use of Bev in someone like him? Do you look at some of the data from Giorgio that was presented at World Lung in Seoul and think about cisplatin and pemetrexed for someone who has an adenocarcinoma? Or do you think about some of the data from this year's ASCO where carboplatin paclitaxel for 4 cycles or some other carboplatin-based regimen followed by immediate pemetrexed? And I struggle with this because I actually think you could make a case for any of these 5 options for treating Mr. Walsh. And I was kind of curious what the group would think.
This is a classic case. And I guess the other thing we should mention is whether or not this patient would have been eligible for 4599.
His anticoagulants,
aspirin and Plavix,
are going to make you worry about Avastin. The other thing of interest in this case, of course, is the very central nature of his tumor. And not only is his tumor very central, but the high SUV uptake is right exactly where his pulmonary artery sits.
But all
this particular case, I think there are some Avastin eligibility issues.
Wait, so all of the subset analyses from both ECOG 4599 and from AVAIL have shown that tumor location is not a predictive factor for severe hemoptysis or for pulmonary hemorrhage.
Can we just clarify the thing about anticoagulation also? Because there are a lot of questions from docs in practice about that, Dr. Wozniak. What do we know about Bev and anticoagulation? That was an issue that came up with the AVAIL study.
Well, it's still actually one of the contraindications if you're on a full-dose anticoagulation. It's still considered a contraindication. On the AVAIL trial, though, there were people who were anticoagulated who did not have any more difficulty with hemorrhage than the patients who were not. So there is also a number of trials, and I think we're going to talk about some safety issues with the subsequent abstracts, but in the ARES trial where they were looking at day-to-day patients on bevacizumab, there were also not problems with the patients who were anticoagulated. So my feeling is that it is probably safe, but it's hard to recommend it right now just because it's still considered a contraindication.
Okay, so Rogerio, let's talk about this particular patient subset, a very important one to talk about. Maybe we can put cost and reimbursement aside, or you can comment on where we are right now in terms of cetuximab with that issue. But how would you be thinking through what might you present to a patient as options?
I think the options that Tom listed are all appropriate options. And as he said, you can make a case for either one of those five options. Personally, I would treat him as in 4599. So that would be my recommendation to this patient.
And patient says why?
Because it's the most mature positive data that we have at this point for patients with stage 4 metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, non-squamous type, that fits all the eligibility criteria.
Mark?
Yeah, I would add one other option. I agree with going down the bevacizumab path in this patient for the same reasons that Ruggiero did. But the more I see the pemetrexed data and the histologic influence of this, I've felt that maybe there's an opportunity to optimize the chemotherapy doublet with Bev and actually have treated some of these patients with platinum, pemetrexed, and Bev. We have some phase 2 safety data. There's a rationale that perhaps it's important to optimize the chemotherapy doublet with a targeted agent. So I would add that as choice 6 in Mr. Walsh's options.
I think Jody Patel's data that he cites with carbo, pemetrexed, Bev is a nice combination. We have data with carbo, docetaxel, and bevacizumab that's nice. And then the SWOG study that we finished the phase 2, which was the combination of carbo, paclitaxel, Bev, and cetuximab, you know, the million-dollar trial, per se, is also something to think about. I would probably lean toward one of the other platinum doublets with Bev as well, giving them the option of either docetaxel or pemetrexed in that situation.
Ruggiero?
So I think the issue with pemetrexed in histology is very provocative, and there's a good possibility that we will be using that combination as opposed to carboplatin paclitaxel. But there's nothing so far that I know of that says that carboplatin paclitaxel is less effective in adenocarcinomas than, you know, cis or carbopemetrexed. Cisgem and cispemetrexed, which is the Scagliotti trial. And then in the maintenance trial, you know, it was pemetrexed versus just observation. And even in the retrospective HANAS trial, it was pemetrexed and Taxotere. So I haven't yet made this move to treat all of the adenocarcinoma patients with pemetrexed-based regimens yet, even though I have to say it's an intriguing observation.
Paul?
Well, it sounds like nobody paid attention to FLEX or the SWOG trial. Okay, so for whatever reason in Boston in years past, they never did FISH. But I would want to know what the FISH result was on this patient. If, in fact, the patient was FISH positive, I would use a platinum doublet with cetuximab for this particular patient. If he was FISH negative, this is a patient I probably would consider a doublet with bevacizumab. As you saw in the SWOG data that Tom presented, if you're FISH positive and you get carboplatin, taxol, and cetuximab, your median survival is 16 months. That's far superior to any data with bevacizumab.
Vince, and then I want Tom to tell us what happened with the patient. But Vince?
I would have taken the Sosinski path on this one because I really like the, I think while the data for pemetrexed may not be completely foolproof in the adenos, certainly we have a trial against arguably the most active doublet, cisgem, where it holds up very well. And I'm quite comfortable that the toxicity is less with pemetrexed than paclitaxel or docetaxel. So that would be my preferred
with
doublet
Bev.
With Bev, I think, in this patient without any provocative molecular data steering me towards one of the targeted therapies.
And would you want to see FISH on this patient?
Probably not, but, well, it's good to complete the data set. Let's get the data set.
So, Tom, what happened to the patient?
So what happened to him was, as we were getting him ready for treatment, he got admitted to the hospital with rapid AF and was started on amiodarone for that. And I was leaning toward bevacizumab prior to that. However, and I think I'm not different from a lot of docs in that with cardiovascular disease and extensive vascular disease, I get skittish about using bevacizumab. And I think that's why when you look at the national use of Bev in first-line lung cancer, it's not as high as it would be around a think tank group of docs who are talking in the abstract. When you're sitting in front of a patient, the guy's in the CCU, I think you can become a bit hesitant. So I didn't treat him with Bev. I actually treated him just with carboplatin and paclitaxel was what he ended up getting. His performance status wasn't quite as good when the time to actually make the decision came to be. I'm curious whether I should have used pemetrexed. It was something that went through my mind. That's probably the biggest debate I have is whether or not to use pemetrexed up front in him. I did not. I gave him carboplatin and paclitaxel, and so far he's doing okay. We don't have, obviously, any outcome data yet.
What about cetuximab?
So I thought about cetuximab in this setting. At the time, it was before the actual data was presented. I was aware there was data that was positive. I just didn't feel 100% there. And the question whether or not cetuximab will be used with other chemotherapy regimens also is one. I wouldn't give this gentleman cisplatin and vinorelbine. I thought that was too toxic of a regimen. And, you know, when you have data that's barely positive, which I think most people would agree with Flex is, I think it brings into question how substitutable are the other chemo regimens. I think they're probably going to be okay. I think that carboplatin, Taxol, and gemcitabine-based regimens and pemetrexed-based regimens will be things that we can interchange. But it's a little bit hard to know right now exactly where we stand on that. In fact, what's interesting is our thoracic group at MGH and Dana-Farber, who gets together and decides what the computer regimens are, we approved cis-vonorelbine cetuximab as our first regimen with cetuximab. And we're still debating the non-vonorelbine cis regimens for approval.
Dave?
Recently, apropos of the histology issue, I know for 4599 data, went back and looked at the adeno subset of that trial. It was about 300 patients. And actually, their median survival was pretty impressive. It was, I think, 14.6 months in that adeno subset. So certainly compares favorably, if not better, than just the Alimta cis data in the adenos.
I'm curious, from your perspective, and what did you call it, the hen house of oncology?
Yeah.
How you see the trade-off of this really instantly controversial subset issue. You know, hearing these things played out, how does it look to you?
No, I think you have to be careful with interpreting any subset data, of course, and planned or not planned analysis. But, you know, with large numbers of patients, to me, it's finally the beginning of an enlightenment when we start looking at tumors based on their, if at the least, histologic subtypes, and then ultimately their genomic subtypes. And that's the way we should be analyzing these patients. And you can't lump them all together, really.
Well, you have a lot of experience with cetuximab, and particularly in terms of head and neck. How do you think the toxicity issues are going to play out here compared to Bev as the educated patient looks at it?
Well, I think that the risk of life-threatening toxicity is far less, but I think patients are going to have some difficulty with the more predictable low-grade effects of rash and skin irritation. I mean, while Bev toxicity is sort of a single-digit serious side effect, the cetuximab toxicity is more predictable and more annoying.
Unless you're in the hypersensitivity belt of...
Right. Yeah, for those people in Dr. Szczesinski's area and west of there, that's a whole different issue.
Mark, what's your take on this issue of the dermatologic toxicity of cetuximab in terms of, you know, how much of a problem you think it's going to be in terms of quality of life?
Yeah, I don't think it's a deal breaker. I think, like Wally said, this is predictable. You can educate the patients. You can treat the rash. And our experience has been similar to managing the Tarceva rashes. And so I don't know that that's a deal breaker with regard to this. Many patients know that perhaps getting a rash is a good thing in terms of the effect of the drug. So I can't really recall a patient. We did several phase 2 trials with cetuximab in non-small cell, and I don't recall a patient having to stop treatment because of the rash. So I think it's a manageable and predictable toxicity. And as Wally was saying, that's not always true with bevacizumab. Bevacizumab tends to be well tolerated, but the toxicity can be unpredictable and catastrophic, whereas you don't see it. As long as you don't have a hypersensitivity reaction with cetuximab, it ends up being a pretty well tolerated agent.
Ruggiero?
I wanted to bring up another aspect of the FLEX trial before we move on, and that's the issue of ethnicity, because I was personally intrigued by that finding in the sense that Asian patients had an overall better prognosis and yet an inferior outcome when treated with cetuximab. And then if you exclude those patients and you just look at the Caucasian population, then the difference between cetuximab and no cetuximab became more pronounced and I think more clinically meaningful. So I wanted to get an idea from the participants, you know, how they see this issue and if there's an explanation for this.
What do you think is going on there, Mark? Do you think it's the post-treatment in terms of TKIs or whatever that's influencing?
Well, when you look at the characteristics of the Asian patients, these were patients who had EGFR mutations and 61% of them got a TKI, which is a great drug. Their median survival was 19.5 months. So these are not your run-of-the-mill average North American lung cancer patients.
Vince?
Yeah, I just think it speaks to the bigger issue that any of these trials we now need to think we do, one needs to think about where they're going to be done and whether that will be a good thing or a bad thing for the drug under study. And it's almost certainly not a neutral if you're going to do a trial in the Asia. It will either impact things favorably or unfavorably for the drug or combination under study because of second and third line treatment or first line.
Can we still legitimately do global lung cancer trials when lung cancer globally is not the same?
There was a paper at ASCO on sorafenib in Asian people. Fortunately, showed in HCC showed that it worked well. But you know, talking to Alan Vanook about it in San Francisco, you know, that's a half his clinical population. I assume, David, we would look at these people the same, whether they're in the U.S. or in Asia. Is that your take?
For the most part, yes. Yeah.
I think the Asians, too, had a lot of the other good prognostic adenocarcinomas. They were females, non-smokers, so they had a lot of good prognostic qualities altogether, and I think that's one of the reasons they did better.
The next issue discussed by the faculty was the use of bevacizumab for metastatic disease, and Dr. Mark Sosinski began by commenting on a current relative contraindication that is rapidly changing, specifically the presence of brain metastases.
The one abstract which should be highlighted was a combination of the PASSPORT trial and then I think approximately 27 to 30 patients that were on the ATLAS trial that looked at patients with treated brain mets from non-small cell that fit the non-squamous category. They were treated. About two-thirds of them had received whole brain radiotherapy, so I assume that these were multiple mets, but some of them had had neurosurgical procedures and some radiosurgery. In that analysis at ASCO, there were approximately 90 patients or so. PASSPORT has completed its accrual to 110-plus patients. You could use bevacizumab. These were first- or second-line patients. The Bev could be used with any chemotherapy regimen you wanted. And I think the data, if I remember correctly, at ASCO, of the 90 or so patients that were there, there was no incidence of CNS bleeding while patients were on bevacizumab and getting chemotherapy. So that data is consistent with all this data. And I am now comfortable treating, if I think the patient's brain mets are effectively treated and controlled, and I typically make that judgment 4 weeks after brain treatment is over. At this point, with all of this data, I'm comfortable using bevacizumab in this setting because of the safety data that's been generated with all this study. The thing that's kind of surprising to me is the rate of CNS progression being so low. I would have thought that that would have been much higher.
The question is whether that's just a different population. Whether
right.
We selected the population, because I looked right. at it and said, that doesn't seem like my practice.
Right. Now, in the coalition trial, which was Carbotax, Carbogem, and Gemtax, I think 18% of the patients that went on that trial in first line had brain mets. I don't think that's been broken down by histology, but brain mets and progression in the brain seems to be much more common than was reported in these trials.
Vince, what about the issue of trying to identify people who are potentially sensitive or might respond to bevacizumab? This is a story that gets discussed, again, colon, lung, you know, five different tumors right now. What do we know about that in general, and what do we know about it specifically in terms of lung cancer?
Well, I think it's a great deal more challenging than trying to come up with biomarkers for EGFR-targeted therapy or other specific molecular lesions, because in part the target may well be non-mutated, you know, blood vessels in a tumor or endothelial cells surface. In part may be the mechanism of action in different settings, may be related to interstitial pressure in the tumor. So although we have seen some preliminary data, John Haymack did a nice presentation on this at Paul's meeting in Santa Monica, I think that there are some hints perhaps of biomarkers, but they are sort of a log order behind where we are with other targeted therapies in lung cancer. I don't know if others know more than I or feel differently, but I think it's going to be a real challenge to develop some guidelines for enriching the population for bevacizumab in lung cancer.
Paul?
I'm going to take the Ron Natale devil's advocate approach here.
Right.
I think there is a concern out there in the world of practicing oncologists about toxicity from bevacizumab, and I think that's real, and I think there is an increase in toxicities. That doesn't mean you shouldn't use it, okay, but that does mean you need to look at the comorbid conditions of the patient and look at the patient overall, like Tom did in your decision about this. I do also agree with Mark, though. The lack of bleeding in the CNS patients has reassured me some, primarily from the PASSPORT study. But overall, there is still a lot of toxicity when you use bevacizumab, and it's a concern.
Rogerio, would you like to respond to that?
I think everybody agrees that there is a higher incidence of, you know, bleeding complications and thromboembolic disease associated with bevacizumab. I think what we need to take into account is, like everything else we do in medicine, is risk benefits. And that's what was reassuring about the abstracts, was most of these complications are manageable and not necessarily fatal. So other than the pulmonary hemorrhage issue, which remains a big issue as far as bevacizumab, I still think that in comparison to chemotherapy alone, you know, the higher incidence doesn't necessarily lead to an increase in mortality.
Mark?
And I think all these concerns are real at the community level. We see the last numbers I saw, only 18 or 20% of patients are getting this drug in the first line setting. And this is a very important, this is a great drug. It does improve outcomes, but it's got to be administered to the right patient. And I think docs see a lot of patients with all these multiple comorbidities, and we have a hard time quantifying that. I think this reminds us that this drug does have real toxicity that can be severe, and you have to be careful.
Vince?
Just a couple of comments. I mean, the other thing about the Bev use or non-use is that we have, you know, question marks regarding the utility in patients 70 or older, which, of course, is the median age of a lung cancer U.S. population. And 4599, you know, treated patients with PS 0 or 1. And certainly a lot of folks see PS 2 patients quite regularly. So those are just some other things that I think are quite relevant to the average patient walking into the office practice.
I want to ask a question, Neil, based on what you said, which is how patients react to this information. And I want to know from the participants if they ever had a patient who actually refused bevacizumab based on the toxicity information. Because I personally discuss the issue of pulmonary hemorrhage with everybody, tell them about 45. I have not had a patient who said to me, well, if that's the case, I'm not going to take it. Personally, I haven't had that incident, but maybe others have.
I had one patient that was the primary concern. And I can't remember which literature they read about pulmonary hemorrhage, but they basically said, that's not for me.
Okay.
And this is not curative treatment, right, doctor? I said, no.
Correct.
Palliative.
And the issue I've had was with what Tom's case brought up was, is that now you have subset data with cis-pemetrexid, you have cetuximab data, and so when they hear those issues, when you balance them, then they start getting a little more confused.